Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors for you. One is Environments for Humans, and they are promoting the CSS Summit, Level Up Your Skill Sets Without Even Leaving Home. It's an online conference. View it from anywhere in the world with an internet connection. The URL, again, there is csssummit.com. Save 20% with coupon code Shop Talk Show. And we have 1 month back. So the URL for them is onemonth.com/shoptalk, which gets you 25% off your first month there too. They have all these classes like Ruby on Rails classes, Python classes, Swift, HTML, and CSS. The idea is it's like 15 minutes a day for 30 days to hardcore level you up in that in 1 month. So onemonth.com/shoptalk. We'll tell you more about those things later in the show, but for now let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast all about hot drama. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Gordon.
Yes, thanks for joining us, everybody. And we have with us a very special guest, Mr. Andy Budd. Hey, Andy, thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. It's such a pleasure to be on the show, man. I can never get over that that intro song. It's just so you. It's so Texas. It's amazing.
I love it. It's new. People are still getting used to it, and I'm getting used to it. But man, it's starting to get me jazzed up like the old one. You know, like punch, sky punch.
So it was raining over there, but it has brightened up in Brighton, England. Where are you from? That's where you're sitting right this moment?
Yep, that's correct. Brighton, England, in the south coast of the UK. So yeah, that's where I am.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's always when we have our UK guests on, it tends to be a little later in the day over there. Have you left the offices and have made your way home?
Yep.
Keeping it at the...
No, I'm done for the day. The office is kind of too noisy and too rowdy to be able to have any kind of sensible sort of quiet conversation. So I'm at home. I've got a quiet space. Everything's tucked away and squared away, and you've got my full attention.
Oh, fantastic. So the office in question then, though, is Clearleft, which people may have recognized because it occasionally wins awards and stuff. They're kind of a popular web design agency over there. Lots of smart people work there, and...
Yep,
fancy alum and all kinds of stuff. So what's the story there? You've been a part of Clearleft or started Clearleft for
a long time. I mean, I'm one of the sort of the original co-founders. It was me. It was Jeremy Keith, who I'm sure you and your audience know, and a guy called Richard Rutter. And we've been going for nearly 10 years. So actually, we're going to be celebrating our 10th birthday. And the 10th anniversary of our conference, one of our conferences, Deconstruct, coming up in September time. So we're really excited about that. So yeah, that's coming up soon.
Yeah, websites have changed a little bit in 10 years.
They might. They have. But also, you know, I appreciate you guys saying, like, you know, a really smart company. I mean, I'm kind of the sort of the founder, and my job is to hire really smart people, which kind of makes me the stupidest person in the room because everyone I hire is smarter than me. So unfortunately, you've got the sort of the wrong end of the, the thin end of the stick today with putting up with me. But I'll try and answer some of your questions.
No, that's part of being a good founder is, you know, you can't, I don't know, you have to say, self-deprecating stuff like that in order to get these smart people to hire.
But it's true. I mean, I don't see the point in hiring really, really smart people and then telling them how to think and how to work and how to behave. Like to be a good boss, to be a good owner, to be a good anything, you know, you want to have smart people around you. And I just find there's a kind of often, particularly on the more designer side of things, there's this kind of weird ego thing that goes on that people want to hire people that they can sort of boss around and tell what to do. So they hire people who are less good than them. But that's just not a good way of getting great quality work out there. So, you know, I joke, but it is true. Everyone in my company is just super smart and embarrassingly so at times.
And then kind of, but with some feedback, right? You don't just hire them and just like give them a room and be like, just do whatever you want.
But you know what? It's honestly not that far off. I mean, we mostly hire people who are relatively senior. Most of the folks at Clearleft, bar one or two, have got 10, 15 years experience. They've got a whole range of tools to draw upon. And so we really trust them. You know, a lot of the research that goes into like what you need to be happy at work, one of the big things is autonomy. And, you know, rather than, you know, have these bosses that do the seagulling, the kind of swoop and poop where they come and stand over your shoulder and tell you what to do. And, you know, that's a horrible environment for people to work in. So generally I'm brought in when things aren't working right, or when, you know, when people have got problems or challenges they need to solve. But until that happens, you know, people are open to tackle the problems in the best way they see fit. And it'd be stupid for me to be telling them how to solve a problem, because, you know, as I take more and more managerial responsibilities, my ability to direct design or code or whatever becomes increasingly out of date. So it makes sense to have the smart people make the decisions.
That's fantastic. You mentioned Deconstruct as well. That's a conference that that you help run, apparently, or that's kind of a clear left conference.
Yeah, that's our thing. I mean, we started Deconstruct 10 years ago. We started Clear Left 10 years ago. Basically, a whole bunch of us, a whole bunch of Brits, folks like me, Jeremy Keith, Andy Clark, we all went to Austin, South by Southwest, 2005. That's the first time we'd ever been to a conference before. It's the first time I spoke at a conference, so it's quite a kind of an intimidating place to kind of cut your speaker teeth. We had so much fun. We met so many amazing people. We made friendships that lasted forever. We made connections with, you know, the likes of you and Zeldman and Eric Meyer, all these cool people. And when we came back to the UK, we looked around to find out what conferences were happening here. And there literally were none. In 2005, there wasn't a single web design conference happening in the UK. So we set one up. We weren't the first. The first actually was our friend Patrick Griffiths, who started at Media 2 months beforehand. But we were kind of like the second one on the market. And we've been going for the last 10, 11 years. So we, you know, we are the oldest running, longest running conference in the UK. And now
so
you
everybody
look at,
else copied you, really.
Oh, totally. Yeah, we're the original, man. But you now look at Lanyard and you'll see in the UK, God knows, there's 500, 1,000, you know, some ridiculous number of conferences that happened, but we were the first and we're still going.
That's fantastic. This year is kind of known as Transform Skew Y Negative 10 Degree Conf.
Okay.
It's been going, I've just seen it all over Twitter because it's a beautiful design for the 2015 Deconstruct site that has the skewed text, which you don't see all that often, but is working quite well.
Well, do you know what? It's just because it's been really difficult to do. We tried to do it ourselves a while ago. We tried to get a really nice sort of skew angle design thing going. With if you go to, I think, clearleft.com/timeline, we've got a little history of the company. And we tried to do skews there, and it was just really performance heavy and it's just horrible. But we've kind of the guys, you know, not me, but Graham back at the ranch has managed to nail it, and it's really good. But the whole theme this year of the conference is kind of like designing the future. So we wanted to have this kind of future futuristic kind of view. So it's all kind of like a mix between kind of 1950s kind of Jetson-y kind of cartoons and kind of a bit of a 1920s kind of World Fair vibe. But it should be really fun. I mean, when we started Deconstruct 10 years ago, it was a web design conference, and it was, you know, a lot of technology, a lot of discussion around kind of like CSS and web standards. But as we've moved, as the industry's moved, our interests have moved as a company. And now it's really philosophical. So, you know, it's much more, this year is going to be looking at kind of past visions of the future. It's going to be looking at how science fiction plays a part in the way that we design today. We're going to be looking at using design fiction to see how designers can you know create the sort of the designs of tomorrow. And that might sound like a little bit of a spacey theme, but my kind of general premise is, as designers, we're all creating stuff now that won't launch for maybe 6 months or a year or longer's time. And so all of us are creating the future. All of us are doing speculative design now that might not exist until a year or so's time. And so we're all kind of, you know, creating the future, which is a kind of, I think, an interesting kind of philosophy. And so that's what we're going to be looking at during the conference, is how we can do this, how we can do it better, how we can get things to market faster, and what the moral challenges are of doing this kind of stuff.
Fantastic. It's going to be great. Check it out at 2015.deconstruct.org. Oh, it's pretty nice. Even the font, Future. Johnny, you do that so good. You know, speaking of transforms, I thought it was kind of interesting while poking around it. It's like, I wonder how like the text selection works on that. Like, because, you know, when you're thinking about an element that you've transformed, and it, a transform doesn't affect like where that box is still is in the document flow. So you'd think that, you know, well, before it was transformed, that box is still there. I wonder if I select text, if I have to select still based on where the text was, or am I selecting text where it is now? And it looks like some smart people thought about that, at least in Chrome. And you do kind of have to move your mouse at the skew angle to select the skewed text up, which is smart, because that's how you'd assume that you would have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, you know. And yeah, it's not something I've actually played with. So you've obviously dug into the site a little bit more than even me, which is kind of interesting. So yeah.
Well, I'm just poking at it now. It's one of those things that you could easily see being screwed up. You know,
oh, totally.
But no, it works out. It works pretty well. So
even in Safari.
Hold on. We could do that a little bit. We were all looking at an article earlier from Nolan Lawson. What do you got, Dave? Do you have an intro for this?
I can do that. Nolan Lawson wrote an article on his blog about Safari is the new Internet Explorer,
which is quite the pretty good clickbait title, you know, because we are, you know, classic thing. You know, I'm sure Andy's heard it 100 times at previous deconstructs and stuff. People, IE's the butt of all jokes. You know, we're almost like bored of it just because it's like, oh my gosh, it's like the easiest slide you can make. You know, and make a little IE joke, and it's like everybody claps, haha, IE sucks, you know. And it's like, yeah, it's because it was true for a long time, and you know, whatever. We're all understanding what's happening there. And so to call Safari the new IE,
bold claim. I think it stemmed from conversations at EdgeConf, which I believe happened in the UK.
Yeah, that was right. My colleague Jeremy Keith went there. He spoke. He said it was an awesome conference. So yeah.
I've heard quite a few things. I mean, both on the progressive enhancement end, and now the Safari is the new IE end. Nolan's kind of argument is there are a lot of APIs and stuff. Or features that browsers need, but when they don't enter Safari, and Safari has it's an open but kind of closed door policy. Like, you report bugs to Apple's private bug tracker, and you don't know how that's going to end up.
I just did that the other day, the first time.
You just did that?
Yeah, it really is kind of a black box. You can only see the bugs that you've reported, not all of them.
So that's weird, but. So he's the argument he is making, and this was also kind of a group discussion, is that there are Safari is kind of the, now they release features once a year, and you kind of cross your fingers and hope that your feature made it. And he's very passionate about local storage, or specifically like IndexedDB or PouchDB. So he's very focused on like cross browser saving data for an offline state. So that's kind of futury stuff, but it's also stuff that's here. But you don't ever get like verbal confirmation, like Safari's like, yep, we're working on it. We want it. We want to fix it. We'll get there. They don't.
So it's a closed box. That's a fair comparison. Fair comparison to old IE, because old IE felt like a closed box as well. That's changed. You know, like
I don't know if I agree with you there. I mean, I don't think Microsoft were ever that closed. You know, I remember, you know, going back, you know, years and years, you know, having really good conversations with guys on the IE team, and they were frustrated, and they found it incredibly challenging. But there was always someone that you could kind of talk to, rather than the kind of completely closed box kind of attitude of Apple. I'd definitely sort of pick you up on the kind of the closed box element. I mean, I think, you know, in some regards, because it's so big, if you didn't go to the conferences and you didn't know the people and get to meet the people on the IE team, but it's not like they kind of avoided these things. They were quite active and prevalent, and the guys on those teams were also, they were the butt of the jokes, and they were the ones that got, like, you know, got beaten up at events, but it's still come. Apple doesn't even bother to come, as you say. And
that's very true.
You know, and I think, you know, as I think
I don't know if there's the answers were there. It was like, okay, are you what's the deal with service workers or whatever the new thing is? I don't think that they would tell you necessarily, or the people that you talked to weren't necessarily the decision making kind of people, or they wouldn't just give you a straight answer on like, don't worry, it's coming in this version at this time kind of thing, which is what you get now. So there's sites like status.modern.ie that just straight up show like, here's a bunch of future features that we don't support yet, and here's the kind of or ones that do as well, and what version it's already in. But it will literally say it's under consideration, or not currently planned, or in development. I mean, it's just as open as can be about what's coming to IE, which is great, and that's what feels new, you know.
Yeah, true. I mean, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think, you know, there was the point when Microsoft basically said, you know, there's no future in the browser, and we're kind of sort of shutting this baby down. And at that point, it just everything kind of sort of ceased to be. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, you know, 4 or 5 years later, they realized that was a really dumb mistake and kind of booted things back up again. But prior to that, you know, a lot of the conversations that I used to have with these guys, you know, it might not be public because a lot of this kind of stuff is sort of airing dirty laundry, and most big companies don't want to do that. But privately, within the IE team, within the Microsoft teams, there was a lot of frustration. There was a lot of desire to do the right thing, but because they had such a massive user base, like the big, you know, Microsoft had always been about backwards compatibility. Microsoft had sort of sold in these big SharePoint systems and these big kind of IT systems to companies that would take years and years and years to update. So quite often the resistance within making changes to IE is they knew that they had to be backwards compatible. They had to kind of, you know, take a progressive enhancement approach to kind of adding features to the browser. So they didn't break like some of their multi-million pound kind of installations. And also it didn't break, you know, the stuff that their parents and grandparents used. You know, I mean, Chris Rawson was always very, very open and honest about that kind of stuff. So, you know, I would argue that that Safari is kind of worse than Microsoft in that sense. I think I think Apple have an arrogance that they think that they're amazing designers, and I think their hardware is beautiful. I think some of their software is okay. If you actually have to use any of their kind of you know, developer services, like we just submitted a new iPhone app for our Silverback usability testing tool, and all the back end for submitting that kind of stuff is just so archaic. It feels like you're delving into like the 1990s or 2000s. And I just don't think they care. You know, there's a kind of a power thing there, which they've never engaged with the community. They never really wanted to engage with the community. And I think Microsoft tried, they just weren't very good at it.
That's a weird look in the web, because it's, you know, all the rest of us, the, you know, the conference scene, the GitHub scene, the blogging scene, all these things are all about sharing and openness and niceness and empathy and that type of stuff. And anybody that's not tends to get kind of ignored or laughed at or pushed away or something. But we can't ignore Apple. Apple's too big. They make too many big, important things for our thing. So it always kind of sits weird, doesn't it, with the rest of us? We kind of have to deal with them. We have to talk about them. But philosophically, well, they feel like the outcast.
We're all 100% bought into their platform too, like from a device standpoint. You know, I'm staring at like half a dozen Apple devices in my periphery here. So it's kind of crazy.
But when did you, at one point you were an avid Safari user like me, and you probably switched, whether that was 5-6 years ago. At one point, Safari was the head of the pack. And it was wonderful being on the Mac and having a beautiful native browser that supported all the latest stuff you wanted. And that stopped. And that stopped with Firefox. And then it stopped with, you know, and then Chrome came out and everyone moved to Chrome. And Safari, I think, is you know, horribly. And I hate to kind of bash other browser manufacturers. But for me, Safari, in some regards, is as relevant as Opera was, you know, 5 years ago. And I know we're stuck with it. I know we're stuck with it on the iPhone. But on the desktop, I don't know. I mean,
There's a lot of them out there, though. There's Safari users, believe it or not. I think it's awful too. But as a developer, the dev tools in Chrome are what keep me there because they're so nice.
Well, and the mobile point is, I think, the big one. You know, for like offline storage, for example, you can do that on a phone, but you have to chuck a bunch of JavaScript to polyfill that on the phone. And as we know, like throwing more JavaScript at a phone doesn't reduce problems. That sort of increases problems. So we're very bottlenecked on a mobile web platform from Safari because it only updates once a year. Every iOS update, you got to cross your fingers, hope everybody updates, and then maybe they do, and then we have these features. You know, Chrome can't even ship new features because they have to use Safari's WebView, or I guess it's WebKit. Sorry, Safari View Controller now, but it's. Yeah, we're very bottlenecked from what we can do.
That would be
a
happy day in the world if Apple said, "Oh, you can have your own browser rendering engine now on iOS." Oh, that would be awesome.
But I wonder if they're in the same position Microsoft was, where it's so deeply embedded and so many apps and people depend on it, they can't ship.
Well, then let those things use those things, but just allow a separate app to. You know, I don't know the ins and outs of it. You know, I'm sure it's well talked about and well considered, more than we can do, you know, armchair.
I don't think it is. I really don't. I wish it was. I think Safari is a small, minor, underfunded part of the big Apple machine that very few people within Apple care about. I think there are some. I think in every large organization, there are passionate individuals that want to push it forward and really care. And I know, and I'm sure you know, plenty of people that have gone to Apple and are doing amazing things with accessibility or you know, with various other things to push Apple forwards. But I think, you know, I'd say 5 or 6 years ago, the web standards philosophy and movement you know, the web in general was very much aligned with where Apple wanted to be, which is why, you know, they were, and it was also great to be seen as being in advance of Microsoft, and they were pushing it forward. I think that is no longer the case. I think where we want to take the web is now out of sync where Apple's concerns are. I don't think it's because Apple, you know, necessarily want to put all of their eggs in the app basket. I just don't think that's where, you know, I don't think that's where their concerns are, you know. If Apple had lots of tools and products and services they were making money with that were delivered through Safari, I think they'd care. But if you look at the amount of effort they put into any of their, I can't even remember what they're called now because they, you know, iCloud, you know, they changed the name around so much. Very few of their services are delivered in that way. So as a business, why are they going to put an awful lot of time and effort into making sure the web and their browser is going to support all these things they're not going to use? I think it's a shame. I think that's exactly the problem that Microsoft had 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. So I think the article's very astute, a little bit too astute, actually. I wish it was wrong, and I hope it's wrong, and I hope Apple see that and prove it's wrong. And maybe we need to get a musician to kind of write a letter to Apple and ask them on the web's behalf to pull their socks up. I can't imagine Taylor Swift is going to be particularly worried.
Yeah. Mumford and Sons are going to be like,
yes. We need to get some kind of hipster beardy kind of group to kind of write a letter on our behalf, and maybe they'll listen. But failing that, I think it's going to carry on this way. And if Safari isn't IE at the moment, I think it might be in 3 or 4 years' time.
All right, Mumford and Sons, if you're listening, please write an open letter to Apple for
our Bandcamp site doesn't
APIs.
Work very good. All right, maybe we should do it. Let's, you know, might as well keep rolling on the drama bandwagon a little bit here. Dave, or you put another link in here, kind of talking about a classic topic. It's related to progressive enhancement, which, you know, if you are aware of that word, you probably often think of Jeremy Keith, another clear lefter who's just has been banging that drum for a long time. I wonder if he makes a mention in this article. He probably, it's hard to talk about it without. Well, anyway,
at least, yeah. So again, EdgeConf has kind of sparked a few conversations about progressive enhancement, and people involved in those conversations are Jeremy Keith, Jake Archibald from Google, and there was a good conversation on Twitter the other day. We can maybe try to find a link, but Twitter conversations are really hard to link to. But Tim Cadleck wrote a post called Thriving in Unpredictability about it. And Jeremy Keith just put one on the Adactio blog called Baseline. His post Baseline it kind of explains here what the thoughts and feelings around progressive enhancement baselines and kind of the drama, because there is this like progressive enhancement is Node.js, and but wait, it kind of is but kind of isn't, but okay, so it's about baselines. What's a good baseline? So it's an interesting topic. I would love to hear, Andy, how you approach it from design or even just and telling your employees what you'd like to see.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there's very little telling people and a lot of discussion and conversation. I mean, the whole point of Clear Left, the reason we set up is because we strongly believe in the power of the web and the power of digital technology. We want to put it in the hands of as many people as possible. We want to take things that are broken and make them less broken. And so we do come from it from a fairly sort of philosophical and moralistic point of view in a positive way. And so because of that, I think I'm definitely, I understand Jake Archibald's point of view, but I'm definitely, and I don't necessarily agree with everything that Jeremy says about everything. But in this instance, I think Jeremy's point of view is definitely much closer to my own, which is this sense that, and it's really weird because, this whole discussion around progressive enhancement, I thought we'd had it. I thought it was clear. I thought we all knew where we were. It seems relatively straightforward to me. And so I'm kind of a little bit surprised that, you know, 10 years on, we're still kind of having these conversations and don't really understand what it means. But for me, I think the goal is we want to get our products and services in the hands of as many people as possible. I mean, it's just good economics, good business sense. And so we don't want to do anything, or we shouldn't be doing anything, that adversely affects that. And so I think it makes sense to build services on the web that work with the sort of the bare minimum facilities or technology possible, and then build on top of those to create an enhanced experience. And I think, as Jeremy sort of says in his baseline post, you know, in order to, you know, create a progressively enhanced version of Jake's SVG sort of encoding service, all it needed to be was a web form and an upload link. And that stuff can happen on the back end. And, you know, and that's it. And Jake's argument was, yes, but that would be slow and it would involve an awful lot of like hassle for the developer to jump through. And I get those arguments as well, and I don't want to be unpragmatic, but I see a lot of decisions being made today, not just when it comes to progressive enhancement, but when it comes to the using of off-the-shelf tools, the selecting of libraries, the selecting of like tool sets. Decisions are being made that are to make the developer's life easier. And that's great. You know, we all want to have an easier life. But I don't want the developer's life to be made easier in the... just cut it there. That would be an awful soundbite. That's the kind of thing you see on the
next
news.
Question.
Yeah,
next Here question.
No, I don't want to make their life easier if it's going to make somebody else's life more painful. Because ultimately, you pay developers to solve the tricky problems so your users don't have to. You pay teams of people, smart people, to make software that works for everybody. So I really want to try and avoid these conversations where I get emails from people using assistive technology or emails from people that are using, for whatever reason, some old browser or text editor or what have or, you know, text browser or whatever, to say, you know, your content or service isn't accessible online, but it could be. And so I think it makes sense to start with an incredibly low baseline and, you know, add layers and add layers and add layers on top of it to create a progressively enhanced experience. That just seems like sense. And that's the kind of, you know, where I came from when I was doing development, you know, 15 years ago. That's the area I came from. And I see no necessity to change. Now, people could argue, oh, yes, but you're not building, you know, massive, kind of complex sort of, you know, online apps and yada, yada, yada. And in these situations, we have to do this. And we have to say that, you know, if you're a user with a certain set of skills or abilities or disabilities, you can or can't use this service. But that's a really, really horrible situation to be in. I don't want to be the head of IT that makes a decision that, you know, my banking app has to use a particular set of, you know, JavaScript libraries because it's going to make my dev team easier, and find that 5% or 10% of my customers can no longer do online banking. That feels like a really, really bad decision. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that sort of is where my standpoint is.
It does. I have some real world stuff we could talk about in a minute, just that's related to some things that both me and Dave work on and the conversations we had earlier about it. I think I'm going to lay it out for you, but first let me do a sponsor real quick. I think this will be good. So speaking of this type of thing and progressive enhancement and stuff, our sponsor, Environments for Humans, have the CSS Summit coming up, the URL CSSSummit.com. It's, you know, we've told you about these things a million times. This is one of their biggest ones. It's coming up July 7th through 9th, and it's all day for 3 days in a row, and you just visit it from your computer itself, and you get all the recordings that come along with it. You can basically relive the entire day, which is, it's kind of a cool way. There's lots of questions being thrown around and stuff. It's a cool way to attend a conference. The first talk on the first day, Jason Garber's talking about designing with progressive enhancement. So these type of things that we're talking about, you can hear people lay out arguments and kind of level up your skill and ability in it by attending that kind of thing. So, you know, no travel hassle, no hotels, no TSA, no, you know, time away from your friends. You can attend these kind of things from anywhere. Attend the CSSSummit.com. If you go, you can buy tickets for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, whatever you want, and save 20% by using coupon code SHOPTALKSHOW as you do it. That's that. So along this progressive enhancement line, I think this is, it's just always kind of perennially interesting thing to talk about. Me and Dave, before this was up, we weren't even talking about the show. Dave's building an app called Daytrip, and I think it's up at least for you to put your name in. It's about, you know, cool things to do on the weekend near where you are. It's Austin only right now, so Dave can give the pitch for it in a minute if he wants. But there's this idea that you're on it and your friends are on it, and you can recommend things to them or whatever. There's this concept of following, just like on Twitter. I can follow Andy can follow Dave can follow me. There's that kind of unidirectional following. You can do the same thing on CodePen. So I've coded up things for that. So there's a back end. You know, there's a database and all these things that know that I'm following this person or not. There's some database structure that goes along with that. And there's a button literally on the website that says follow. And if I click it, then I'll be following that person. And there's a state change that happens. That button changes how it looks to represent the fact that I am now following that person. And Dave is building this thing in Rails, and he's talking about how do I set up the routes? How do I deal with the Ajaxing and stuff? There's kind of a, you know, this is kind of a, just a classic infrastructural thing. And
I just want to do it like a smart way. I don't want to do it the Dave Rupert way, which is very, very uninformed, but I want to do it like kind of a known pathway.
Yeah, right. Like this has been 100,000 zillion people have coded this before. It's like, how do I code a drop down menu and stuff? Why do I have to think about this from scratch? I probably shouldn't. There's probably frameworks to help me. Or is there? Maybe there's not. Well, you are using a framework on the back end. You're using Rails. So I'll set up a route to accept that data, and I'll save that data to the database. Now, okay, you click that button, and I trigger an Ajax call to the thing, and I'll change the state of the button. That's how, and I can tell you, we're Rails app at CodePen too. That's exactly how we did it. And I also can tell you that button doesn't do a damn thing with JavaScript off. And I know that progressive enhancement isn't, so that's a different conversation, or it's a related conversation. Is progressive enhancement the same thing as JavaScript on or off? And I know that's different than baseline. I haven't read Jeremy's new article, but there's alternate pathways you could take. One of them could be that follow button is a form element, and it posts to the server, and the server accepts the data and saves it, and it refreshes the entire page in that old school way. And that now that data is saved, it loads in a different state because it can. So there's certainly a way that you could build this with progressive enhancement. Another way is just to maybe not make that feature available, but as the data loads from the server, could tell you whether you're following them or not. And I don't know. There's like different choices you could make here, different baselines, if you will. What are do you intend to think about that as you build this, Dave? Are you gonna build a JavaScript free version of?
I just want to jump in here. I'd argue that I think you're using the term baseline wrong. There are not different baselines. You're deciding whether you want to use a bunch of pre-written tools that are going to make your life easier. And because you've decided to use Rails and you've decided to use whatever other tool sets that you've chosen, and because out of the box that makes that simple thing of doing a button and doing a follow thing difficult, you're making a decision about the amount of hassle and hoops you're willing to jump through in order to deliver a service that is open to all. And that's your choice. For me, I would step back and say, well, hold on, is actually Rails the right, you know, library and set of frameworks to use if it actually makes it difficult to do really, really simple things? And that's one of the challenges I think you face when you pick, weirdly, when you pick a kind of a tool set or a library like this. These libraries often make, you know, very, very difficult things easy to do, but very, very easy things actually really difficult to do.
I don't know if that's fair in this case. I don't think Rails is making it harder or easier one way. I think if there's any fault here or if I made the bad choice, it's kind of on me. I don't know that Rails, like, in this particular case, and I'm sure there's cases where you're right and that picking a particular tool set does kind of more heavily influence the choices that you make.
Well, then, but I mean, in that case, you've already outlined the solution, and it seems like a perfectly reasonable solution. It's a button that has a refresh, or it's a link that, you know, sends a, you know, a state change to the server and it comes back and yada, yada, yada. Why can't you do that using your, you know, Ruby, and then you add in the interactivity through JavaScript on the top? But when you take that away, it still works. What is it in your system, your setup, that isn't allowing you to do something which, I mean, there might be some nuances of what you've described that I don't fully get. And as I said, at the sort of the head of the game, the head of the show, you know, I'm a lot less, you know, hands-on code these days than I used to be. So I might be like missing something completely obvious. But
no, you're not.
Exactly. And you're making a decision based on time that might end up inconveniencing hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of your users
and limiting
its growth. And you've got to make that decision. But I think using the argument, oh, it's a baseline, is kind of like a really bad attempt at kind of a get out of jail free card. I think you just need to own up and say, I've decided that I'm no offense, but I'm too lazy to put the effort in, or I see a little reward to put the effort in for these people. And I'm just going to make it clear that, you know, for you guys, I don't really care about your experience. Now, for me, that's not the kind of web I want to live on. And that's not the kind of attitude I want to instill in my designers or developers. I want to have people that are building stuff for everybody, not a subset or a select few. And I don't mean to give you a hard time here, but this is something I feel really passionate about. And because I think it's also a thin end of a wedge, because the example you've used is a really simple example. But you can just see people taking that and going, well, okay, if I don't have to have this thing work, I don't have to have that thing work, I'm going to have my whole UI generated through JavaScript. And if I go to the page and I don't have JavaScript on, it's just a blank page with nothing. I'm going to have my server-side code write the JavaScript for me. And you know, you start getting into this kind of elevation. And if the argument is, oh, well, look, it's a decision we made this decision to have this baseline that you have to have XYZ plugged in. I think that's a really, really dangerous route.
Yeah, I mean, so the situation I'm in is right now, it is the kind of slow, hard, you know, it is the like hard refresh. Send a request from a form, you get it back, the page is re-rendered.
Oh, entirely. You already did it the right way. Nice.
Well, that's how it works out of the box. So that's how I've started. And so in the number one bug report I have right now is people are like, oh, when I click the button, it refreshes the whole page. And so it's like,
that's funny. They want you to progressive enhance it there or whatever.
Yeah. They want the enhancement. So I'm working on the enhancement. And so, and I realized that would make it better too, because when you know, like, let's say I follow somebody and then I want to go back one page, I can't just like swipe back. I have to swipe back twice because it's made two different pages at this point in the history. So I'm just trying to like just enhance it. But the situation I'm finding myself in is I'm having to build out, and I'm very pro progressive enhancement in accessibility, but I'm just finding myself like, okay, well, I'm going to build out this logic inside my JavaScript. But then I'm going to have to like rip out that element in, like, so it, let's say that the follow button, somebody clicks the follow button. I'm going to have to say like, okay, you click the follow button. The request succeeded. I'm going to rip that out. And then I'm going to put in an unfollow button in its place. And so I have to do that in both the JavaScript and the Ruby. And those are different enough. It's not just like a text update. It's like inject a whole entire form with a different route. And it's all based on like a user ID that I get returned from the server. So it's sort of turning into this kind of like, wow, I'm managing two different properties. And
that's why it becomes so easy to say, well, you know, and if I don't get this thing done in 2 months, then nobody's going to care, or our funding dries up, or I can't work on this problem we're having with churn, or, you know, that's why it's sad. It becomes so easy to backseat these things, unfortunately.
And I want to do it the right way, or like I want to try, but I'm finding myself like, okay, well, I'm going to do this here. And I already have the next like six places where a button like this occurs. So now I'm like, well, SHIT, I have to like do all this code like all over again, because it's, you know, it could be an abstraction, but there's kind of like different routes and it functions a little bit differently, just a tad in each different place. So I'm kind of like sitting here like, geez, is like a big monolithic JavaScript framework suited to handle this and better? And should I just do this in JavaScript? But again, like you're saying, I want to try to do this the correct, most responsible way, but I'm also having like conscious problems. Like, geez, I don't know. Like, is it sustainable to do this over and over and over and over?
I feel your pain, and this is the pain of a lot of developers, and it can feel frustrating that you've got to jump through all these hoops and you've got to maintain two code bases. You've got to do all this stuff on the back end and do the same stuff on the front end. And if you could just do it in one place and not have to worry about these things, then that's great. On the other hand, there's a quote that I think was wrongly related to Winston Churchill. I think it's actually from a guy called Edmund Burke. It said, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And this is what I think is true with the web as well. You know, all we need to be constantly doing what's right. Because if we don't do that, if we just do nothing, if we do what the easiest outcome in is, easy opportunity, then it's this slippery slope. And, you know, one day in 10 years' time, you'll be trying to do something really important online, maybe life or death. And you'll get to a page and the very same, you know, attitude, you know, has got pervasive, and you'll find something that's really, really difficult and frustrating and annoying. And you'll curse the developer for not having the thought or the time to do it right. But it's exactly the same problem that you're struggling with at the moment. And so it's tough. We all need to do this stuff. We all need to do it right. We all need to do it better. But like I say, I think a lot of it is that, you know, if we're building things from the ground up, if we're building things, you know, I know it's not very popular at the moment, but if we're building greenfield projects without the help of all these kind of quick accelerating kind of tools, we do things right out of the box. If we're going and using pre-built tools, we naturally tend to use the attitudes and philosophies that they've instilled. And some of them have progressive enhancement right in the core of them, and others you've kind of got to work around and hack around to get that in, and that becomes a pain. So that's kind of why when we're, you know, evaluating tool sets at Clear Left, you know, we look at things and we want to make sure that they, you know, they have that philosophy at the heart, and also they're not doing things like, you know, forcing you to download, you know, megabytes of code that are never going to be used because all you want to do is like change the line under a, you know, a link or something ridiculous like that. You look at so many tool sets now that are bloated and messy and big, and half of the stuff, you know, three quarter of the stuff you never ever use. So, but it's tough, and you know, each individual developer has to make their own choice. I know where we're sitting. We're definitely sitting in the, you know, making products that are open to as many people as possible. But, you know, and I think that's the right way. But, you know, other people, other views, are also there.
I think I like that attitude. I like Jeremy's ending to his baseline post, which is, I'm going to strive to keep the baseline as low as possible. And I think that's awesome. I just, I'm finding...
Dave, you did a talk once on the cost of responsive web design and then decided that it was, that's kind of a misnomer, you know? I wonder if that type of thinking can happen here too. And it's not really.
But it's the same argument about, you know, I hear people talk about the cost of responsive design. And I'm thinking, well, what cost? If you're, you know, if you are doing it right and you have been doing it right for the last 10 years, the additional cost is almost minimal. It's negligible. The cost happens when you haven't been doing it right, when you haven't been building, you know, fluid, flexible layouts, when you've been building fixed width layouts, when rather than coding your own stuff, you've been relying on stuff that other people coded that you have no control of. Then it becomes a real pain, because then you have to make all these workarounds and you have to, you know, build things in a way that's really alien to you. So, I think a lot of these, you know, we very rarely see any big cost in this stuff. It's just because we've been doing it this way forever, because we've got good practices, it just comes naturally. It's only a problem if you don't do this out of, you know, by default.
Speaking of building things, we have our sponsor 1 month. The URL for 1 month is it's a place where you go learn how to do things online. 1month.com/shoptalk. The idea is that there's all these courses, classes that you can take that take 1 month to take. So you could take one of them if you want to, which is $49, or you can have access to all of them if you want, which is $99. And if you use the coupon code /shoptalk, you get 25% off. So it's just $37 or $94. And you can take one on content marketing, iOS development with Swift. You don't even have to worry about progressive enhancement with Swift. It just works. Oh, just kidding. I bet their version of progressive enhancement is like network connectivity and stuff, which matters on the web as well. But anyway, that's an aside. There's courses on Ruby on Rails, which presumably teaches you the correct way to build things with Ruby on Rails. Python and stuff. That's 1month.com. So you start, it's 15 minutes a day for 30 days. So it's not a huge commitment kind of thing. If you get stuck, there's real people that help you out. You know, they have people on staff to guide you along, which I think is probably fairly effective, especially because there's like one project that they do. They probably know that project like in and out. So they've seen the stumbling blocks and can help you along. So I'm kind of a believer in these things. You know, it's just teaches you the modern stuff. They can move a little faster than a university might be able to. So you end up building something that's like in the vein of Pinterest or Instagram or Yelp. Those are some of the apps that you build, you know? So you have this kind of like, what is a modern app like? Well, it's like Pinterest. Well, that's what you build then in Ruby on Rails and the thing. So pretty cool. Get access to any of those classes. 1month.com/shoptalk. Have we even made it to the questions yet, Dave?
Nope, we got one question. We got time for one question. No, maybe a couple here. Drew McAllister writes in, I work at a web agency where our main revenue is from brochure-type websites, where I am a team leader for a front-end team. I have some great developers that I work with. However, sometimes I have a hard time conveying the fact that we don't have to do stuff on our websites to please the clients that we don't like.
Well, he says sometimes we have to do stuff on websites.
Sometimes we have to do stuff on the website to please the client that we don't like. For example, in the classic where the client wants to make sure that everything works in IE9. So we build a great site. Then one guy on the board of directors has an old laptop and doesn't upgrade. Then he puts a big stink and threatens to find another company to build the site because it doesn't work perfectly in IE9. So then we have to dumb down the site to give other users a less than great experience because we have to cater to this one VIP in the organization. I would love to have in the budget more time for progressive enhancement. However, typically we find that we do more graceful degradation. When I have someone who is a great developer, however, has been trained to focus on progressing the web, building with the latest technology, and has little training on how real-world clients, How, that's a very big run-on sentence. We'll work on that together. How can I help them understand that we have to slowly educate the client, but in the end, the client writes the check? More importantly, how can we explain so that he is happy to do so? So this is kind of a two-ended question. Drew is hitting the CEO who has an old laptop. So how can he educate the client? And then how can he make,
well, Drew's the boss. Drew is Andy Budd in this scenario, right? He's the boss, and he has these developers who build sites, and then progressive enhancement, which we already talked about a ton, but also that he has these great developers that work for him that they're great, but they don't dig the progressive enhancement thing as much. So he wants to like instill this like, you should care about progressive enhancement. You should care because our clients care, and I wanna explain that to you in such a way that you buy into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think it's packed full of so much interesting stuff there, and we, from the sounds of it, probably don't have the time to go into huge amounts of detail. But I don't know. I mean, first off, I've always been a little bit nervous about the whole idea of educating the client, because a lot of the time the clients don't want education. You know, when I have a burst in my pipes in my house, I don't want the plumber to come round and start telling me all about his wrenches and this new PVC piping that he's using. I kind of just want to get it fixed. But using that similar analogy, very rarely do I find the client actually wants to understand what you're doing. So as long as you go in there and you act like a professional and you say, this is what professionals do and this is how we behave, and this is how much it's going to cost to deliver this professional service, then actually clients very rarely care about the details. So my argument would be, you know, you don't, because, and I guess where I'm coming from is, there's a lot of people I hear will say things like, how do I sell in progressive enhancement, or how do I sell graceful degradation, or how do I sell a responsive site? My argument's always the same as, you do it right from the start. You know, you presume that, you know, all good professionals, this is how you're going to behave. Now, that might mean that you guys are a little bit more costly than your competition. But I believe as a company owner, then you can go and you can explain to your boss in this situation, well, this is the difference. You know, we're going to spend a little bit more money and time on your site, but that will mean that your CEO, who has an older version of IE, will get the same content. They might not get the same experience, but they get the same content. It will be very, very close. And everyone on even older browsers and all this kind of stuff would also, you know, get the really important things. And that's the beauty and that's the benefit of doing progressive enhancement. Graceful degradation then means that you end up having to make lots of the term's escaping me now. Lots of decisions based on, we are going to do this for this browser or not for that browser. And that starts to get really messy. Exceptions, that's the word I was looking for. So I think progressive enhancement and a good, you know, approach to design will help solve some of those problems. How you get your team interested in it, I guess it's just, you know, hiring smart people, sending them on to some of the training courses that you guys have been promoting, you know, during the show, and the books that are being written about this. I mean, I think Aaron Gustafson's book on the subject of, I can't remember what it's called now. It's not
Adaptive
web design. That's it. It's a really, really good place to start. And a lot of this stuff, it isn't actually really complicated. It doesn't take an awful lot of extra time, if any. I think the other thing, though, is sometimes from a business point of view, sometimes you do have to say no to clients. You know, I think there's a fear that clients have all the money and money is really, really valuable and important and talent is everywhere. And I think that's wrong. I think actually there's lots of money out there with lots of clients, and the stuff that we do, the stuff that you do, the stuff that your questioner does is actually really, really highly skilled and really, really sought after. And so because of that, we don't need to be worried about you know, producing stuff as for the cheapest, you know, way possible. Because my experience is, you know, maybe I've been very lucky, but most of the people I speak to is like, you know, I'll take on a really a project that I don't like, and then a better project will come along and I don't have the capacity to do it. And sometimes saying no is actually the best thing, because if you say no and you explain why you can't do something this way or why it's going to be bad for them, the better clients will probably up their fees. And the clients that you're going to ultimately not enjoy working for are going to go and work for someone else who is willing to cut corners and make mistakes and make compromises. And the number of times that we've said to our clients, we're not going to do something, or prospective clients, we're not going to do something, or we need to charge you more because this is not the way that good design works. And they'll go with another agency and they'll come back to us in 3 or 4 months later and say, God, I wish we'd gone with you guys at the start, because once we launched it, we had all these problems and all these people phoning up saying that it didn't work on this platform or that platform or whatever, and it was a headache. And had we just spent that extra 5% or 10% with someone that did it right, you know, everything would have been good. And so sometimes I think you just need to have the strength of your convictions and the ability to say no, but the ability to explain why you're saying no. Not in an arrogant way, but just in a, you know, this is not how best practice works. These are the risks you're facing. But also sometimes, you know, we don't live in a perfect world. Sometimes you just need to pay the bills. But if that's the case, I mean, hopefully every project you do isn't just to pay the bills, hopefully. But if you get into a situation where, you know, like your bank balance is going down, you need to take on a project you wouldn't normally take on, you do need to bite the bullet sometimes. But even then, try and bite it in the best way possible.
Lovely. Good luck to Mr. Drew McAllister. It sounds like you, at least you have your head screwed on good and stuff. I wish the best for your business. What do you got, Dave?
Well, should we do one more question, or do we have to wrap it up here? Are we good for one more? Let's see. Here. I have a question. It's an audio question. I'm going to dig it up because we haven't done an audio question in quite a while. So let me find it here. It's from Pete, and I can't say your last name because it's French. So Pete writes in. Hold on 1 second.
Hello, Shop Talk. I'm currently binge listening to your backlog. Thanks for all this great content. I have 2 questions for you. I was recently let go from an enterprise level company and was not given a reason why. It took me by surprise. I thought I was doing really well there. And I've not been able to get an explanation despite asking multiple times and of different people. I'm having trouble finding the words to explain why I was let go to potential employers. Any advice as to what to say in interviews when the question comes up? My other question is addressing something that a recent potential employer called out. They said they normally wouldn't consider me because I've not been with the job for more than about a year, and that's a red flag. Is this a red flag with a lot of employers? Should I address this? And if so, how?
I thought this might be interesting since, Andy, you probably do a little bit of hiring and letting go. Maybe not. But what would you give advice if an employer let you go with no reason really why? Would you hold that against them?
I mean, that's a really, you know, I feel sorry for your, you know, the situation your listener finds themselves in. I mean, it's a difficult one because in the UK, there's a lot of employment law around the ability to let people go. I know in America, you can sort of like, you know, you can come in on Friday and say, you know, you're not back on Monday. And that seems to be acceptable. Particularly, I know a lot of my friends in San Francisco that work for very well-known startups who have been cut free, not because of any attitudinal problem or anything like that, just because the company decided to go in a different direction and they want a different set of people with a different set of skills. And so people can find themselves out of work really quickly. In England, you have to give at least a month's notice, often 3 months' notice. You can't just let someone go. You have to have given them an explanation beforehand. You have to give them an opportunity to kind of change their behavior. So it's a really difficult one because it's not a situation I found myself in. I feel sorry. I mean, it sounds like your audience member has asked and has tried to get to the bottom of what the problem is, and they're being really reticent. The difficulty is, as he says, you know, this can seem a bit weird to prospective clients. I would never sort of normally suggest people sort of lying in a job interview, but if this had happened to me, my reaction probably would have been to say that I decided to move on rather than I was let go, and explain why that wasn't working. In terms of the other sort of part of the question around length of time, I think if I see a CV, if I see a resume that has lots and lots and lots of jobs that have all lasted for very short periods of time, you know, I'm thinking like 4 or 5 jobs, and each one of them has only been there for a year and a half, that does make me think that that person is not likely to stay with me for very long. And it could be a bit of a red flag. Either this person is kind of a little bit flighty, or maybe difficult to work with, and, you know, this pattern of behaviour is formed. On the other hand, it seems really common in San Francisco particularly that you'll go and work for Google for a year, and then you'll be, you know, poached by Facebook for a year and a half, and then you'll go and work for Twitter. I know, you know, lots and lots of really, really successful people who have, you know, move on every sort of 12 or 18 months. So it doesn't seem like it's that that damaging. I think you just got to have a good story around it. And, you know, that story might be that you went in and you did the work that was needed to be done, and you moved on, and you're looking for bigger challenges, that you're, you know, an opportunity came along that was too good to miss. You know, there's lots of reasons why you can craft a narrative that makes sense. But I think when you're going into the interview, to have figured out what that narrative is in advance, rather than kind of feel like you're being cold cocked and you end up making stuff up on the spot that doesn't feel genuine. But yeah, you know, it's a tough situation. I mean, you know, to answer one of the things that you said on the way in, we've never had to let anyone go at Clear Left. You know, we've had people leave, but typically people stick around for like 3-4 years plus. We've been fortunate that we've never ever had to kind of fire anyone. So it's a difficult situation. But if I was the person letting that person go,
why?
As a boss, I would totally tell them why. You know, you've got a duty to that person to kind of let them know to their career. So it kind of seems to me that if that agency or if that organization was being really quiet about it, it's probably their fault and it's probably not your fault. Because if it was your fault, they would probably let you know. I would have imagined, unless they're worried that, you know, I mean, I guess America's a little bit more litigious. Maybe they'd be afraid of the litigation, but. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's all I've really got to offer on that front, I'm afraid.
That's pretty strong. I agree entirely. I'd say, Pete, you should lie when you go into a next interview. If they're not going to tell you why they fired you, they're probably not going to tell anybody else either. You know, they're not going to call somebody on the phone. They're going to be like, who's Pete? I don't know. So just be like,
and again, the other thing is it's worth looking at what the employment law is. I mean, I know, for instance, in the UK, you're legally not allowed to give people a bad reference. You can choose not to give a reference, but you can't say anything negative. And so what ends up happening in the UK is if someone asks for a reference that someone wasn't very good, then you might say things like, oh, you know, he was really relaxed about his timekeeping, or, you know, their attention to detail was elsewhere or what have you. But you can't say that person was an asshole, or sorry, I swore, I do apologize. You can't say if that person, you know, was mean or nasty or abusive or any of those kind of things, because that would actually get you sued. So it might be worth looking at what is legal in your state about what can and can't be said in references as well. But just don't use them as a reference. I mean, another way around it, again, I'm not suggesting that your listeners should do this, but if I was in that situation, I might just say I was contracting there for 9 months. You know, it wasn't a full-time job.
There you go.
It was a contract job.
There you go.
I was freelancing. I spent 9 months freelancing. And
then I went back to freelancing. So there's no red flag for the next time, too. It's not, you weren't unemployed while you're gone. You were working for yourself, man. Pete LLC.
It was an engagement.
Hell yeah, it was.
Engagement.
Don't be like, I don't know. I'm hard on life, man. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm free floating here. I'm free floating. Anything you got, I'll take it. You know, don't be like that. Be like, I might work for you if it seems like it's better than my current excellent gig as a, you know, I don't know. You know what I mean? You don't have to. It's a white lie. All right.
I mean, if you really are like a job hussy and you're just chasing that dollar, I mean, you may have to suffer the repercussions of that. But I mean, yeah, you're just going to have to. I think it's all about positive spin. I mean, some people lie about what college they went to and they get a fake degree printed up.
Check.
You're not in that boat. You're just in the like I worked for this company in for 9 months and then the engagement ended. You know, I mean, that sort of happens all the time in my line of work. So
and just one final thing. I mean, I guess if your audience member is still, you know, really wanting to get to the bottom of this, it might be that the boss or his line manager won't tell him what was going on. But I suspect some of his colleagues, if you take them out for a beer, if you go down the pub, have a chat, they might be able to fill him in on the background. And it might have been that it was something, you know, towards his attitude or his work. But it might equally have been some other stuff within the business that he had no knowledge or control about. So I'd just talk to some of your you know, trusted friends in the company and you might get to the bottom of it there.
That's good advice. All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have. Andy, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate you taking time out of your day, telling us a little bit about Clear Left, Safari Drama, and Progressive Enhancement. Really appreciate that. For those who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that? And then what's one big thing you'd like to plug before you go?
Andy Budd on Twitter. It's the easiest way to follow me. So come along, say hi. If you've got any questions out at the back of this, then I'm always relatively approachable. So just shoot off a tweet and I'll be happy to help. In terms of plugging, sort of, you know, no massive plugs. I mean, I guess we talked about Deconstruct, we talked about Silverback. Those are the kind of two big things that we're doing at the moment, other than kind of working with some awesome clients. So that's mm-hmm. where we are, I guess.
Well, great. All right. Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. And thank you, listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Do us a solid here and give us 5 stars or whatever it is they do in that. And that's how people find out about the show. That's how people learn. And follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And if you hate your job or are looking for a job, check out shoptalkshow.com/jobs for your employment future. Chris, do you got anything else for us here?
Oh. ChopTalkShow.com.